Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 225, I chat with master home theater designer Dennis Erskine about his approach to acoustics and other matters of great importance to all home theater geeks. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded September 25th, 2014, episode 225, Home Theater Design and Acoustics. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by The Books, beautiful, affordable flowers, grown on an active volcano and shipped for free. For 15% off your first bouquet, visit thebooks.com/twit and use the code TWIT at checkout. That's thebooks.com/twit and use the code TWIT to save 15%. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of avsforum.com. This week's guest geek is Dennis Erskine, CEO of the Erskine Group, as you might expect, a home theater installation company. He's also the vice chair, one of the vice chairs anyway, of Cedia. So he's got a lot to say about home theater design and acoustics, and we've got a bunch of questions lined up for him. Dennis, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm certainly glad to have you here. Those of you who are tuned into the live stream at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Dennis, along with the ones that I've already collected on AVS, and I'll pass along as many as I can. But I want to start, Dennis, with Cedia, which is, as the expo, the show, the annual show put on by the organization, Custom Electronics Design and Installation Association. I'm so glad they shortened it to Cedia. We just finished that show a couple of weeks ago. And of course, one of the big stars of the show was Dolby Atmos and the whole concept of three-dimensional immersive sound technologies. So I'd like to start by getting your take on all of that. What do you think? As an installer, is that something that you think is going to become very common or just in certain circles? What's your take on it?
My sense is it's going to become standard. We'll see that in more and more installations. And we'll see it either being, we'll see various levels of success in the installation until there are more of them out there. But people have been trying to get to this world of height and width and all the other variations on it in a reasonable fashion. And I think one of the things that Dolby did by their architecture is to allow more flexibility in the numbers of speakers and the location of those speakers than in some of the previous attempts where speaker locations had to be rigidly fixed and the studios and the post-production houses had to be, it was so onerous to do, they just never came out and never produced anything that would provide that, where the original mix was, if you will, 3D. And I think now we're getting in that direction, and I have for years discouraged people from attempting to use ambience extraction technology to create height and width, because in any given playback environment, it either worked really well or it worked really poorly, and mostly poorly.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned Dolby sort of having a flexibility of speaker placement, which they do. And I'd like to hear what you have to say about that in terms of contrasting it with Auro, the other primary 3D surround immersive sound system. While there were a dozen demos of Dolby Atmos at the show, there was exactly one of Auro 3D, which calls for, I think, a more strict, well-defined speaker placement, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a stricter regimen that you have to implement in terms of where you're going to place your speakers. And one of the challenges is if somebody wants to utilize both, you got a problem, because the only thing you could really do is follow the rigid speaker placement method of RO and then go into Dolby and describe where the speakers are so their objects can correctly map the sound. It would be more effective to put in a whole bunch of speakers and have a whole bunch of channels and turn on RO for one and turn on Dolby for the other. I think over time,
in other words, have two separate sets of speakers, one optimized for RO and the other optimized for Atmos.
I think that's the way that you're going to get the best results out of both of them. Yeah.
Well, I know we have a couple of questions that were posted on AVS regarding RO and Atmos as well, so we'll come back to that in a little while. Before we get to them, though, and some of the questions that are already coming into the chat room, I did want to talk about a couple of your most recent projects, and you were kind enough to send some photos. Let's start with the dedicated theater, which I know we have a couple of photos of. There's one right there. And a similar one sort of from the other side. Tell us a little bit about this particular project and what you did here that made it special.
Well, it was a challenge to begin with, because this in fact was a concrete bunker. I use bunker because it was concrete on all six sides. This is in fact this is the space under a three-car garage.
Wow.
And we had to bring in, there was a sump pump in one corner of the space and the HVAC in another. So some of the challenges were the HVAC for the room and the sump pump for the house is located behind the screen. And guess
what?
Well,
that could be a little problematic in terms of noise anyway.
Yeah, well, you can't hear it now. We went to some great length to make that happen. And if you notice that the picture you're showing, you will not be able to tell, but the right and left side panels are, in fact, doors. On the right side, that one you're showing, that's a door that goes back behind the screen area into the HVAC and sump pump area. And on the other side, that door opens up into an auxiliary equipment rack. There are, in fact, two racks, one in the main equipment room and one in the room itself. The other challenge we had is the homeowner obviously was very concerned about egress in the event of fire. So there were various things we had to put in to provide them with a safe method of getting out of the house, up the stairs and out through the garage as opposed to the main house. But it all came together. And obviously a concrete bunker does provide its own base response problems, but we dealt with those and dispatched them with great care.
There was one other picture I have of that, which is a crane dropping the screen into the room before the roof was put on.
That's a different project than the.
It is. I'm sorry. Misunderstood. I misunderstood your message then. But it's still an interesting story, because if I'm not mistaken, that's a Stuart Starglass screen, right?
That's correct.
And that is a rear projection material. It's basically a thick, clear, semi-translucent, I guess, acrylic that you shine the projector on behind it. And so it becomes essentially a giant flat panel, right?
It does. That is all glass. It's 12 feet wide. Exceptionally heavy. I made sure I wasn't there when the crew was installing that piece of glass, because I didn't want to have anything to do with it. But you can see how high the house is from the street level. And there was going to be absolutely no way to get that piece of glass into the house once the room was closed in. So we had to bring in a crane and drop it up on the platform before the roof and all the walls are up. Otherwise, it just wasn't going to get there.
Right, right. Was that the project, one of the multipurpose rooms that you sent me some pictures of? Maybe I just mislabeled it.
Yeah, it's one of the, it was the one in the first two pictures on that list that I sent you that had the.
Was it Ohio or Texas?
This is the Texas project.
Okay, let's take a look at the Texas photos because we do have a few more of those to look at. And these are multi-purpose rooms, which means, you know, not only a home theater, but also there might be a bar or a wine cellar or other stuff going on in the room that you have designed. Tell us a little bit about this project.
This project, you can see in the far left in the back, that's actually a very, very large aquarium. Many people don't have swimming pools as big as that aquarium. That is showing the whoops, you're getting faster than I am, but anyway.
There we go.
There's the equipment space, which is behind the screen. And that is a Christie Digital high frame rate 4K projection system.
That's a fully commercial digital cinema projector, right?
That is indeed. Yes. And it's a high frame rate. So, we can get 60 Hertz per eye in 3D.
That's amazing. So you can show, the Hobbit movies and that were both shot at 48 frames per second per eye in their native frame rate in that home theater.
Yes, we can. The other thing is along that right wall, as you're looking back into the back of the room, those are windows. There's six windows down that side of the room. And what we did to keep the room quiet was there are two sets of windows. There is an exterior set of windows which matches all the windows in the rest of the house. There's an interior sash windows that were built by us to match the interior of the room. And in the gap between the two windows, we have some motorized blackout shades that come down, and they're blackout, and they do have some acoustic absorption properties. What you see in that picture are the interior white shades that are dropped down. And those shades are typically used by the homeowner during the day for sun control and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And then we have another multi-purpose room just to show you brief pictures of from Ohio. Mm-hmm. And we can take a look at those. We don't have very many. You didn't send me any pictures really, except this one of the theater area. You can sort of see it in the corner. But there are some other shots of this multi-purpose room. And I wanted to ask you, when you're designing a theater, how do you approach it differently? There's the wine cellar inside the same room, more or less, as the theater. How do you approach these rooms if it's dedicated as opposed to if it's a multi-purpose room? Or what are the differences you have to consider?
Well, there are two primary differences in these rooms. One is that you have to be very careful about the picture quality or the customer's expectation of the picture quality in a multi-purpose room, because what they're expecting to do is to watch a presentation when the lights are on in the rest of the room, and that is very difficult to do and maintain good black levels on the screen. Mm-hmm. So the issue here is you have to set expectation of the homeowners to what they're going to gain or lose in a multi-purpose room environment. In the case of the Texas project, we had walls on the left and right side of the room. And we still had the light problem, but because we had wall surfaces on the left and right side of the room, we were able to create a much better acoustic environment. In the case of the project in Ohio, if you look at that one picture that shows a flat screen behind the bar and off in the distance on the left, you see the screen. One of the reasons we showed that is to show how bright the projector is actually pumped up. That's about 60 foot Lamberts off that screen.
whereas the cinema standard is around 14 to 16.
Exactly. But in this particular case, we had a wall down the left side of the room and no wall on the right side of the room. Mm-hmm. And so now to create a reasonable sound field, we had to go to some extraordinary efforts on the left side of the room in order to make it sound more like the right side of the room. It was so there you go. There's actually two surround systems in here. There is the theater with the big screen, but in the bar area, there's a 65-inch plasma, which is to the right of this picture, mm-hmm. that has its own 5.1 surround system.
Huh. So people in the bar can have their own 5.1 separate from those in the main theater.
And there you're seeing where that plasma is, and it's an ability to show multiple images on that device at the same time. But that is a fully standalone 5.1 system with the speakers mounted in the ceiling. We used some Triad speakers up there, and they came out very, very well. The ceiling in that area, by the way, is a copper ceiling.
Wow, that must have presented some acoustic challenges.
It did provide some acoustic challenges, but you have to admit that it's a gorgeous-looking ceiling.
Well, you know, this brings up a very interesting question about when aesthetics, visual aesthetics, and audio-visual performance conflict. How do you resolve them? How do you resolve that conflict?
The only thing that you can do is have a discussion with the homeowner when there is a divergence between audio-video performance and the aesthetic needs of the homeowner, to explain to them the pros and the cons of doing it either way. The pros and cons of doing it the performance way and the pros and cons of doing it the way they want. And at that point, they can make an informed decision as to what they want to give up in order to get the aesthetics or the function of the room that they want. Mm-hmm. They may say, geez, we didn't know we would be giving up that much of the audio-video performance, so we'll change our thinking. And in other cases, they'll sit there and say, I don't care if the wife doesn't have her gorgeous copper ceiling. It's a non-starter. So all you can do is inform the customer. And there have been a few occasions in our history where we've basically resigned the account because the performance on the audio video side was going to be so poor that we didn't want somebody walking in, seeing how poor it was, and have the homeowner say, yeah, that's an Erskine Group project.
Yeah, I gotcha.
And you know, it wasn't a situation where both parties walked away mad. It was simply, we understand what you want, and you understand what our reputation's all about. So it doesn't make sense for you to be paying us to deliver this pristine audio video space and not have any of it at the end. I mean, you're paying us for our advice, and our advice isn't being taken. So.
Right. So find someone who you can work with. I think that's a valid way to go there.
Exactly. You know, find the interior designer or the architect, because obviously the priorities are not audio video, and there's no sense paying us for our specific expertise if you're not going to be able to take advantage of it.
Right. A number of people in the chat room are asking, and I know you probably can't reveal any specific numbers, but looking at these home theaters that we've now looked at, some of your projects, they're all asking, wow, how much does that cost? And I assume, you know, that we're talking in the six figures here, typically. I mean, these are custom-made rooms with digital cinema projectors and, you know, 12-foot star glass being lifted in by a crane and all that kind of stuff. Can you talk at all about the sorts of orders of magnitude that you typically deal with?
Well, I can. All of those rooms are 4K environments. Mm-hmm.
And you're referring to video resolution there.
Video resolution. They're all 4K UHD projection systems. All of those rooms are in the six-figure range. One of them is actually just over the limit and became a seven-figure room. But it's in addition to the house.
Yeah. You know, so I'm only talking about the room, your service.
Well, the room in our service on all of those is in the six figures. But, you know, it's a mistake to think that that's all we do is six and seven figure rooms. We do rooms that are five figures. Those particular rooms are, in fact, in the six figure range.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just a little point here. You might want to move the boom mic down slightly. We're getting quite a bit of pop. So if you just move it down slightly, that should help. SoundPro 69 in the chat room is asking if you could elaborate on why it was such a challenge to obtain a similar sound field on the left versus the right of that last multipurpose room we were looking at. One reason, of course, is that on one side it's not a wall, it's open. And on the other side there is a wall. So he also wants to know how did you address that problem?
Well, the reason we do that is that in reality, when you're in a room, 80% of the sound you hear is coming from the room. It's not coming from the speakers. And so the room has the biggest single impact on sound quality, more of an impact than the speakers have in the end. Mm-hmm. And so when you have a wall on the left side of the room, you're getting reflections off that wall. When you don't have a wall on the right side of the room, on the other side of the room, the reflections that you are getting from the far walls in the room are so far delayed and so much reduced in SPL than on the left side, you get this terrific imbalance. You can hear that. And that kind of ruins the suspension of belief, if you will, that the movie is trying to create. And so what we had to do on the wall side of the room is we had to provide more absorption than we normally would and more diffusion than we normally would. So it's abfusion on that side of the room so that we could more accurately provide an equivalent sound field on the left and right. In the case of, you look at physics, there's really no way to do that. But what we had to, exactly, but what we had to do is reduce the audible effect of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cider Fries in the chat room is asking a question I really should have asked at the outset, which is, how long have you been building home theaters?
Who is this?
His name in the chat room is Side of Fries.
Oh, okay. Well, longer than Burger King has been. No, we've been doing this for coming up on 20 years now.
Yeah, yeah. And that's one reason I wanted to have you on the show was because you've got a lot of experience in this area and can offer lots of interesting commentary upon it. And in fact, you can we can now start, I think, asking some questions that were posted prior to the show on AVS Forum. I had posted a thread saying, hey, got any questions for Dennis Erskine, by the way, who is also an AVS member. So you can find much of his stuff there as well. Let's start with Jeff in Canada. By the way, I'm going to be using only online member names, usernames, some of which may not be too pronounceable or I might get them wrong. So this one's easy. Jeff in Canada asks, what type of acoustic treatment do you recommend at the first reflection point on a wall? Diffusion, absorption of low frequencies and reflection of high frequencies? He has a couple questions, but let's start with that one.
Well, it depends upon the speakers and depends upon the room. Mm. There is no set answer to that. If you have good off-axis response from a speaker, then you can look more towards diffusion than reflection. But if the speaker is closer than, say, 3 to 3.5 feet from the wall. Then you need an area of great absorption to avoid speaker boundary interference response. And so there's no pat answer. You cannot take one room and copy what they did and put it in another room and expect the same results.
And in at least one of the questions that was posted on AVS, one at the end of the question, it said, and I hope the answer is it depends. And I was expecting that because, of course, it depends on the room and the where the speakers are within the room. It's not as simple as a simple simple straight answer.
So it also depends where the seating position is with respect in relation to the walls and the speakers.
He also asks, how do you use a riser as a bass trap? A lot of AVS members have dedicated home theaters in which there are at least two rows of seats, and the second row is up on a riser. And a number of people I've read about have taken to using that space as a bass trap. Is that something you do? And if so, is it a good idea? Well, it must be if you do it, but...
It perhaps is a misnomer to refer to it as a bass trap. It's what we're using that riser for is a pressure absorber, and it acts on, it has greater effect on the modal frequencies in the room. And it's deliberately designed to do that. And what we are doing with that riser is we're basically taking the modal frequencies and we're reducing their amplitude. So when it comes time to tune the room for modal response, we basically end up having to do almost nothing.
Okay. And modes, I want to make sure everybody understands, are certain frequencies that resonate within the room, and they depend upon the room's dimensions. And they're mostly problematic in the low frequencies, in the subwoofer frequencies. And so reducing their amplitude or evening them out is a very important aspect of theater design, which I'm sure, Dennis, you spend a lot of time thinking about on each project.
Yeah, we do. And the way those pressure absorbers are working is that the openings into the space below the riser are in a right tri-corner or against a wall. And as such, that is where modal frequencies are at their lowest velocity, highest pressure. And by absorbing that pressure or diminishing that pressure, we're basically reducing the amplitude of the modal response.
And thereby smoothing out the bass response throughout the low frequency range, so that they all those frequencies sound the same and not one of them jumps out at you as it would if you didn't tame those modes.
Right.
Yeah. Beatmaster in the chat room asks, how far are your customers into 3D versus 4K?
Most of the customers are not into 3D at all, but they're all the current ones are looking at going to 4K, and we are still discouraging them from moving into 4K at this point in time.
Even though you installed, for example, that Christie Digital 4K projector in that rear projection system, tell us why you're trying to discourage them at this point into going into 4K.
Let's go back to the Christie issue. This was a case where the homeowner not only wanted it, but had the disposable income to resolve many of the problems currently unresolved in the 4K residential marketplace, which is the bandwidth required to get 4K material at a high frame rate into the projector. In that case, in order to get the 3D 4K to that projector in a high frame rate required four DisplayPort ports into the projector. HDMI wouldn't do it. The other issue is there is you have to be careful that you are getting HDCP 2.2 in all of your devices, or you're going to have inconsistent problems with 4K. Now, the other problem is the real thing that we're striving to get to with 4K is not only a higher frame rate, more pixels, but we want more quality pixels. So we want to get a greater color depth in Rec. 2020. And now the bandwidth is expanding to the extent where it is beyond the capacity of a single HDMI port currently.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the question is, how is the industry going to resolve this? Are they going to go to two HDMI ports to a projector, or are they going to go to a black box and talk DisplayPort? This isn't all resolved. And so the issue here is, if you can go to a commercial installation from a budgetary perspective, then we can deal with that and we can adapt as the future goes ahead. But if you're going to go to a consumer design for the residence 4K projector, what you have to be prepared for is that projector will not be compatible with the ultimate 4K distribution method in the future.
Mm-hmm. Which, as you say, has not yet been fully and completely defined.
It's not fully vetted. So, the recommendation is, unless you want to buy a new projector and perhaps a new transport mechanism and different cables and so forth in the next year or 2 years, then stick with what we know works very well. And mm-hmm. upgrade later.
Yeah. Yeah. Papalock, one of AVS members who, in fact, was featured in a home theater of the month, who does a lot of his own. He's a serious bass head, so he works a lot on his subwoofer system. But the rest of the system's great, too. He asks, what is your method for determining speaker recommendations in a room? And he lists several possible factors: customer performance goals, budget, room dimensions, et cetera.
All of the above.
Depending upon in different proportions, depending upon the project, I assume.
Well, yes. The way we get to equipment recommendations in a room is if somebody would call me up and say, hey, I've got a room so big, what kind of speaker should I get? I wouldn't have a clue. We haven't engineered the room. We don't know what the seating distances are. We don't know what the ambient noise floor in the room is now or is going to be in the future. So with that, we don't know how far you're sitting from the speakers. That's going to tell us whether we need compression drivers or horns or Lord knows what in order to get the high frequencies out into the seating position at recorded reference. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know the characteristics of where the walls are with respect to the left and right center speakers. So we don't know what engineering specifications or capabilities any given speaker or amplifier must have until we've designed the room.
Mm-hmm.
So once we come up and we say we have to have these following technical criteria must be met in order for this room to perform within what we would call reference. And now we have the technical specifications. And from those technical specifications, we can go and find speakers and amplifiers that meet that requirement.
Got it.
So, but until then, you have no clue.
Right. Okay, well, we got a bunch more questions in the chat room and also from AVS. But if you'll forgive me for taking a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, I would like to do that right now. And that new sponsor, thank you very much and welcome to the show, is The Books. Have you ever tried to order flowers online? chances are you've kind of been burned. There are hidden shipping charges, chintzy upsells, and worst of all, what shows up doesn't look like what you ordered. What's that about? Well, thebooks.com is changing the way you order flowers online. That's thebooks.com. Books, because they took bouquets and simplified them. The Books offers roses, lilies, daisies, and more in beautiful, colorful, and creative arrangements. Thebooks.com sends flowers straight from the sustainable, eco-friendly farms located on an active volcano in South America. Seriously, volcano flowers. How cool is that? The South American volcano is 10,000 feet above sea level, which means more sun. And more sun means more color in the flowers. These Books are fed by pure volcanic snowmelt and mineral-rich soil. The Books cuts their flowers, your flowers, on the day you order them, and they're shipped straight from the farm, so you get the freshest Book possible. And all orders are backed by the Books Happiness Guarantee. Hey, you can even sign up for the Books Concierge Service and arrange for the Books to automatically deliver flowers on birthdays, anniversaries, or just because. Best of all, the pricing is upfront and the checkout process is painless. Your loved ones will get beautiful, unique flowers, and you save cash. To send your loved ones incredible flowers grown on an active volcano, visit thebooks.com/twit. Books start at just $40, and you can double the number of blooms for just $10 more. And you'll save 15% off your first book by entering the code TWIT at checkout. Plus, you'll get free shipping within the U.S. That's thebooks.com/twit. And remember to use the code TWIT to save 15% at checkout. And we thank thebooks.com very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. Now, somebody in the chat room.
May I just point out one thing? You've mentioned volcanoes.
Yes.
I can see two volcanoes from my house.
Oh, my goodness. I hope they're not active.
Yeah, they've been active recently, but.
Yeah, which one?
Mount St. Helens.
Holy smokes. Were you living there at the time?
No.
Wow. My wife was in Portland at the time, and even she got, you know, there was tons of ash and stuff that far away. It was amazing.
Yeah, well, I can see Mount St. Helens and Mount Hood from here.
Wow. In fact, I'm going to show everybody. This is totally off topic. When my wife and I were in Seattle, I bought this little thingamabob, which shows dust from the Mount St. Helens eruption at 5 miles distance, in which the grains are pretty coarse, at 22 miles distant, when they're much finer, and at 250 miles distance, when it's a fine powder. So anyway, wow, you're in sight of two volcanoes, one of which erupted violently not too long ago, as far as geologic time is concerned. Well, best of luck, and I hope that it stays dormant for a long time to come. Okay, now let's get back to some questions here. Where was it? It was Slow Joe. I know it was Slow Joe who asked about, do you usually install professional equipment, high-end consumer, or enthusiast hi-fi level equipment? Probably, again, it depends.
Depends upon the engineering requirements. Our amplifiers are typically amplifiers that come from the commercial world. Mm-hmm. They are very capable. They are very neutral. They are not tone controls. And typically they are considerably less expensive than boutique brands with equally or better performance. When it comes to surround processors, there are a lot of factors that go into that. We also have to recognize that when we're into the consumer world, virtually all the decoding chips come from the same place. So there's not a lot of difference between them. And surround processors in this day and age are very, very good at the consumer level. Obviously, there are surround processors that are better. And the thing that sometimes will distinguish them is whether you can get 7, 8, 16, or 32 channels out of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly that becomes more important with the rise of Atmos. When you're going to need more channels, and I know Atmos isn't channel-based, it's object-based, but you still, the more speakers you have around you, the better the illusion, I think, generally
well,
speaking.
You have to devote a channel on that processor for each of those speaker locations.
Right. Exactly. Laird Burkett in the chat, at AVS, rather, is interested in DIY acoustic treatments. Do you have much to say about that? Or I'm sure you mostly, do you build your own acoustic treatments or do you contract that out to acoustic companies in particular?
We do not build our own acoustic products. We know too much about the science and manufacturing that goes behind them. And while we can have CNC machines make very specific diffusers and so forth, it's not something that's economic for us to do. Mm. Anybody that's into doing DIY acoustic treatments, I have to come back and say, folks, something is better than nothing in most cases.
Mm.
But when it comes to building diffusers and so forth, the people who design those and build them are at PhD level expertise. It's a complex field, and you just can't put various squares and loops and irregular surfaces and expect to get a proper diffusive field. But all of our products are engineered products. We get them from manufacturers that build them. We have an individual that we work with frequently that has designed some of those. And if we have a special requirement, he can design those, but we'll go to a third party to manufacture it.
Mm-hmm. Scorzani on AVS asked a related question. If someone is on a limited budget, just starting with acoustic treatments, what is the first or most important treatment to start with?
There are two areas that you need to be concerned about because they're the most obvious. One is the reverberation time in the room. You can't listen to dialogue in a room that has an echo. And the second is the modal frequencies, which you can reduce the impact by changing your seating position, which is not the best way to do it. But the first thing is watch out for the reverberation in the room. And mm-hmm. the problem there, the good news is you can use things like curtains and carpet and 2-inch fiberglass behind fabric and so forth to do that. You just have to be careful that you don't overabsorb because you'll take all the sparkle out of the movie.
Mm-hmm. That's great advice. I totally agree with that. In terms of the room modes, what about a subwoofer position? I've always believed that had a great deal to do with how the room modes were managed. And if you have more, and it's better to have more than one, two to four, positioned in such a way that can also even out the modal problems.
Yeah. In fact, 5,000 subwoofers is the best way to do that. And of course, sure. You would know that it's a speaker company that came up with that. But
yes, of course.
What happens with subwoofer location, whether you're using one, two, or four, is that you can position the sub in a location that does not excite the modal frequencies. If you shove the sub into a corner, all of the modal frequencies peak in a corner. So if you put a sub in there, all you're doing is making all of your modal frequencies go bananas in the room. So you want to move it into a moderate area. So you can manage it that way. When you go to multiple subwoofers, if you're using two, the neat thing about two is typically we'll find that a moderate area in the room is about a third of the way back and about a third of the way in from the side wall, which happens to be in front of somebody's seat in the front row. Mm-hmm. And tripping over that subwoofer is not a good thing.
No.
But you can. But what happens is with two subwoofers in the room, they behave as though there is one subwoofer located halfway between the two.
Oh, isn't that interesting? I hadn't thought of that before.
So you can find that moderate spot and then position your subwoofers. And the neat thing is if you increase the volume on one subwoofer, it tends to move that spot closer or further away. And so you can begin to reduce modal response problems by doing that. When you get into four subwoofers, it's a little more complex. But the thing that people miss when they're reading the multiple subwoofer issue, and they put four in and they say, I get smooth bass response in the room. No, you don't. What you get is consistent bass response in the seating location. So it's equally good or equally bad in all seating locations. But what is good about that is it's saying if you fix one seat, you fixed them all.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. More or less. Yeah. Yep. Darkroom08 in the chat room is asking, how many of your customers are asking about or looking for Atmos upgrades?
Almost all of them.
Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't really be surprised about that. And Tim McGee from AVS asks a related question. How does acoustic treatment change, especially on the ceiling, with Atmos, Oro, and these immersive 3D audio systems?
I can't address Oro as much as I can Atmos. But I am finding that there is not a lot of difference in the use or the requirements for acoustic treatments when you're using the multiple height speakers in Dolby Atmos. The thing that you have to be concerned about is that you're now putting speakers, if you're using the ceiling-mounted speakers as opposed to the reflective ones, where you're aiming it up in the ceiling and counting on it reflecting back down, is that what people are starting to do is they're taking standard speakers and mounting them up against the ceiling. And that is not a good thing to do. Because
why
what's happening, you're changing the timbre of the speaker by putting it next to a surface. If it wasn't designed to be against a wall, and one of the critical things that Dolby will tell you and Aura will tell you as well is that all the speakers need to be timbre matched. And so you start taking a freestanding speaker or a speaker that's designed to be mounted to be installed away from a wall surface and you mount it to the ceiling. That speaker now sounds like somebody's talking at you in a cardboard box.
Mm-hmm.
Because it accentuates the mid-range. So you have to be careful doing that. The other thing you need is to use a very wide dispersion speaker.
For that ceiling speaker, you mean?
Yeah, and I've also discovered in working with these rooms that the location for the ceiling speakers in a small room, in a typical residential room with 8-foot ceilings and so forth, more smaller speakers is better than few larger speakers. And you want to use care that you try to keep all the speakers equidistant from all the seating locations.
You don't want one speaker very close to a seating location. I discovered this, I think many of us did, at Cedia when we were listening to all these different Atmos demos, and somebody was sitting directly under one of the ceiling speakers, and they said, hey, I can tell where that speaker is exactly, and it's kind of distracting.
Yeah, but if in that same room, if you were to sit in the center, when they switch back and forth between the reflected ceiling, the reflected speakers and the ceiling mounted speakers, you couldn't hear the difference. But when you're sitting close, when you're in the center of the room, you were a good average distance from all the speakers, so you didn't get that preponderance of noise from one.
But if you were sitting on the side,
if you're sitting on near the side, one of the,
and they switch between the up-firing speakers and the direct in the ceiling speakers, you could hear a big difference. That's certainly true.
So I found some positions in a room where if you're only using four ceiling speakers that will help reduce that effect. But I kind of like the idea if you have the budget to afford it. And the reason I say that is the Denons, Integras, and so forth, Pioneer and so forth, that are coming out with Dolby Atmos surround processors. Mm-hmm. They won't support more than four ceiling speakers.
Correct.
So that means you're going to a Trenov or a DataSat system, which begins to have an impact on your budget where you can have more channels. But right. A whole bunch of small speakers down the sides and down the center of the room over the listening areas and slightly in front of and slightly behind the listening has a much better impact than simply four slammed up on the ceiling.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on direct ceiling mounted versus those up-firing Atmos enabled speakers, as they're called?
You know, that's something that's going to depend upon the room. For a space that is already built, probably a speaker that will reflect up onto the ceiling is going to be better.
As long as the ceiling isn't acoustically treated itself and absorbing all that sound.
Yeah, if you've gone and put up a whole bunch of absorbing panels up on the ceiling, you're kind of toast. You're going to have to take them down, or there is another way you can do that. Rather than taking the panel down and throwing it away, if it's just like a fiberglass panel under fabric, take the fabric off and install some 3 mil plastic or 6 mil plastic on top of the fiberglass and then reinstall your fabric. That way it will become a high-frequency reflective and mid-range absorptive.
Oh, that's interesting. Hadn't thought of that. Okay, that's a good idea. Sandblaster in the chat room asks, when you test a room to determine the acoustics, do you actually go in and measure with microphones or use computer models? I assume both.
No, we do both. In the design area, we use computerized models. And these models have been tweaked over the years based upon real-world experience. Most computer models for determining or predicting the acoustic properties of a space were never designed with small rooms in mind. They're all designed with large auditoria. And large room acoustics is something that's very well understood. Small room acoustics, not so much. And so once the room is built, and you know, this hasn't come up, but we're one of the few design and installation companies that is also a construction company. So we do build all this construction and millwork we do ourselves. Once the room is built, yes, we do. We go in with multiple microphones and do at least a day of measurement in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Kicking speakers around and moving treatments around, tweaking them here and there to get the response we want.
Sure. David K442 from AVS asks a related question. What is the minimum room size required to obtain top-notch results for a single listener?
It's infinite.
In other words, a phone booth would do, eh?
Well, actually, out in an open cornfield would be the best because you don't have any walls, you see. I don't know what the minimum size would be. I mean, the first thing is you're going to have to be comfortable in the room. But you know, I can see getting down to a shower stall probably is too small.
Mm-hmm.
Although reverberation hides an awful lot of flaws in our voice.
Yes,
but I wouldn't be able to tackle that. I in you know, the problem is you get a room that's too small and you get real problems with low frequency response, as well as problems with respect to HVAC and cooling and so forth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Raj Deep from AVS has an interesting question. Can a single system with the same front left right speakers serve both as a good quality home theater system and to reproduce two channel music?
Not a chance.
Mm.
Not a chance. Here's the difference. In the world of two channel, sometimes referred to as dual mono.
yes.
The surround processor is your room. That's your surround processor, the room.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As you said earlier, the room actually contributes more to the sound that you finally hear than the speakers themselves, and in this case, even perhaps more so.
Right. So now you go into the multi-channel area where you're dealing with surround and so forth of that nature. The acoustic treatments are different. The reverberation time requirements are different. The room is no longer your surround processor, and you cannot have a good two-channel experience, dual mono experience, in a room that's properly set up for multi-channel or vice versa. If you have a good two-channel room, you try to do multi-channel, it'll be way too reverberant. You won't understand the dialogue, and it'll be an unpleasant experience. Now, I'll go back and say that if you have a excellent multi-channel room and you listen to two-channel sources and do ambience extraction for multi-channel, that is far, far better, far more rewarding and higher quality than you would get from a very expensive two-channel, two-speaker reverberant room setup.
Hmm. Now, that's an interesting idea. I'm certain that most audiophiles would not go for that because it's mucking around with their two-channel source to say, what? You mean I'm going to send this audio through a processor and actually create ambience in my... Of course, they wouldn't have multi-channel rooms to begin with, so it's probably a moot point.
I had a customer like that, and he wanted the theater built first, and after the theater was built, he was going to put his two-channel rig in there and decide whether he was going to build a separate two-channel room or not. The end of that story is he never built the two-channel room. He listened to all of his two-channel sources through an ambience extraction, but let's look at exactly how poor two-channel recordings are, regardless of how well they're put together. Mm-hmm. When you have the microphone in that room, you are recording the direct sound from the instrument. You are also recording onto that microphone for the left and right channel the reflected sounds that come off the seats, the chairs, the walls, the ceiling, the stuff that makes Meyerson Hall sound different than Mechanics Hall and so forth. So now you put that on two channels. Here's what you've got going on. The speaker... when you're playing back, you're going to get the direct sound that was recorded directly from the speaker, direct sound to direct sound. You're also going to get the reflected sound to your ears as direct sound.
Yep.
Which is not supposed to happen. But by the same token, that direct sound and the indirect sound is going to reflect off your walls in your room, so that is also going to come to you as reflected sound. And so now you've got a confusing mess. The neat thing is we human beings – have heard symphonic presentations in symphonic rooms and jazz clubs and so forth. Our brain knows what it's supposed to sound like. So our brain does an awful lot of the correction processing for us.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that is called fatiguing. And,
right.
and frankly, a good ambience extraction processor will do a better job than your room anyway. Because it can see that. It can see that. And it can extract that and put it where... reasonably where it ought to be.
What do you have an example of what you consider a good ambience extracting processor?
There are several. If people want to email me, I'll give them suggestions.
Okay. All right. Very good. Fair enough.
And just as a disclosure, because I am a member of the board of CEDIA, I can't be favoring one vendor over another in a forum like this.
Right, of course.
And I wouldn't do it.
Right, of course. Which is also one reason why, if someone were to ask you, what do you have in your home theater, you can't really talk about that either. The other reason, of course, like me, is that you got stuff coming in and out of there all the time, I'm sure, to evaluate.
That's true. And the other thing is I just moved 3,000 miles.
Well, there's that too.
Yeah.
So you got nothing right now.
The best multi-channel sound I have is in my car right now.
Yeah, there you go. MTB Dudex on ABS asks, with 3D audio coming on strong, Atmos and Oro, do we have enough knowledge to effectively implement such systems in the home now, or should we wait for a year or two until the technology is fully understood and things have settled out? Something like what you said about 4K video.
Right. I think that there will be some settling of the dust in the 3D audio arena. But it is going to be more, it's not going to be as radical and show-stopping as some of the, in other words, what you get now is not going to prevent you from doing something in the future. Mm-hmm. So unlike
potentially 4K video.
Right, right. 4K video, you could find yourself out in the cold without a jacket. In the 3D audio world, that won't be the case. We will discover tricks over time, but that does not say that you cannot get an absolutely stunning experience now. And why give up on a stunning experience? Because you might get a 1% improvement 2 years from now.
Well, actually, you mentioned MTB Dudex also mentions retrofitting existing systems, and particularly points to your rooms and how do you tend to use tray ceilings. We saw those in some of the photos earlier. Are those going to pose a problem for retrofitting those rooms for Atmos, or would you not even consider it?
No, actually, they would facilitate being able to do that. In rooms that have coffered ceilings, we have those coffers are wire chases and convenient places to install speakers without tearing through the drywall. And the trays that go around the room are, in fact, wire chases, HVAC chases, and hollow spaces that are designed for future expansion of height speakers. Now, they may not be in exactly the right position, but we haven't come across a request to retrofit a room yet that we didn't have a place where a speaker could not go and effectively do the job.
Mm-hmm. Vic Grau at AVS asks, have you ever been involved in any private IMAX theaters?
Anybody who's been involved in a private IMAX theater is under non-disclosure. Not only IMAX, but the people who put it in.
Okay. All right. Because we recently heard that IMAX was now becoming available to exceedingly well-heeled consumers who wanted to install one. But I guess you can't talk about that, can you?
No, I think the original, and this is pretty widely known, the original getting in price for an IMAX theater, this didn't include construction or anything like that, of the room, was $2 million. It's higher than that now. So you're exactly right. It's a very, very limited marketplace for that. And that's about all that can be said about it. Now how... Mm-hmm. How widely IMAX theaters will be sold in private residences, I have no clue.
Probably not very widely if it's going to cost seven figures. But
it's not going to go in my room, that's for sure.
Yeah, really? Render Mandan at AVS asks, what, if anything, can be done for wall treatments or acoustic treatments if you don't have flat walls to hang panels? For example, if your first reflection point is a door.
Put the panel on the door. We do that all the time. In fact, in fact, if you go back to the picture of the room that was in the bunker, and I said in the left and right side of the screen, you saw those acoustic panels and nice wall.
Right. It's not this one. It's the one called Dedicated 1 and 2.
Right. Okay. Most of the panels that you see in that picture right now are doors. On the left side of the screen, that's a door. On coming down the sidewall, those are storage cabinets.
So, and they all have acoustic treatments on them.
Right. So you can put acoustic treatments on a door.
Mm-hmm.
And
there you go.
In our concealed doors down the side of the wall, you will find sconces on them as well. And you open the door and the sconce is part of the door.
Oh, wow. That is very cool. Well, I'm going to give the last question to SoundPro69 in the chat room, who asks, how can people who want to get started in who want to get into the home installation business, how do they get started?
Join Cedia, start taking classes, and find somebody who you can work with or is willing to mentor you to do this. But also understand that it is a long process to get to a level where you are very confident that you won't run into something you can't handle.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a fun road. And that's one of the purposes of Cedia, is to provide the training necessary for people to enter this field and to give them the knowledge they need to succeed in it, both from a business perspective and technical perspective.
Yep. And certainly the Cedia Expo that was just a couple weeks ago, you could spend all your time in classes and not even see the show floor, because there are so many classes offered, as you say, both on the business side of things and on the technical side of things. And I could easily see one spending several years sort of getting up to speed on all that stuff, and then some years as an intern or an apprentice of some sort. Does your company ever do any kind of internships or apprenticeships along those lines?
We haven't done internships or apprenticeships, but we have taken on people and mentored them. Mm. And three of them currently have their own successful businesses now.
Hey, there you go. Well, this brings us to the end of a fascinating discussion, and I want to thank you so much for being here. Dennis Erskine, you can find him at the Erskine Group. That's ERSKINE-group.com. And find out a lot more about his installation company and all the stuff he does. Dennis, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Good. Glad to hear it. You can find me, of course, at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and also at avsforum. And you can find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here on twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/HomeTheaterGeeks. Next week, I'll be pre-recording Home Theater Geeks on Saturday, September 27th, a mere 2 days from when I am speaking, because next Thursday, I will be deep in preparations for a part of the Jewish high holidays known as Kol Nidre, which is the end or the beginning of Yom Kippur. So I need to pre-record that segment and that show, and I hope that you will join me for that, because I'm going to be joined by AVS senior writer Mark Henninger for our quarterly Q&A session, open Q&A. You can ask us anything, hopefully related to audio, video, home theater, that sort of thing, in the chat room. So be sure to tune in and get your questions ready for Mark Henninger and me as we spend an hour chatting with the chat room. That will be on Saturday, September 27th from about 4 to 5 p.m. Pacific time. Depends on what Leo Laporte needs to do after the Tech Guy show, which he records that day. But it'll be roughly around that time. So do hope you will join us for that. Until then, geek out.